Welcome to Minority Corner, where we take an introspective look at the world through an intersectional lens. I'm James, he, him. I'm a queer political activist, actor, comedian, self-proclaimed sexy blurred. That's a black nerd. And each week, I'm joined in the corner by other fabulous minorities and some allies tackling the news, pop culture, politics, media, entertainment, and history with a little self-care, self-love sprinkled throughout, all for our own personal and collective empowerment. It's a surprise Minority Corner Rewind Special Edition. With the recent violent attacks towards the AAPI community, most notably the tragedy in Atlanta where 8 were killed, fueled by racism and misogyny, there seems to be a disconnect for some that this was, in fact, a hate crime. And that's because folks don't know their history. So whenever there's been a crisis or an attack or a moment that needs healing or education, if we've talked about it before here on the show, I like to resurface it. So in preparation for the next 2 weeks of guests and conversations that I imagine we're going to be diving into, as a sort of a primer, I thought it was important to lay down the framework. So in the first corner, you're going to get two corners here this week. So in the first one, well, actually, it's actually the second part of my investigation into immigration. The first one was about the Bracciato program. That's another episode. We're not doing that today. Different subject matter. But in this one, I look specifically into immigration from overseas, from Asia. And we talk about the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, what that was, and how that spawned even more racist laws to uphold the white majority. And also, we connect the dots and figure out where the myth of the model minority comes from and how it was actually really, if you think about it, a tool to be used by the dominant caste to pit us against each other. And I'm sure that we're going to be diving even further into this idea and concept and unpacking that in the coming weeks. So a nice little primer, as I said. Then, in honor of Women's History, Aneke's Corner, bringing that out of the archives on Zheng Yatso, the badass Chinese pirate who in the 1800s led a fleet larger than the Chinese Navy and was one of the most successful pirates to ever have existed. And you probably never even heard about her unless you listened to the episode a couple years ago. Caveat, though, upon further research and as time has evolved, have come to realize that Aneke's pronunciation of badass pirate Zheng Yatsao's name is not correct. Early on in the MK days, we were just two kids who we did our best. So bear with us. Apologies in advance. We were young. Forgive us. But the information is golden. It is there. So here we go. We're pulling in some extra credit this week because the times call for it. As we review and rewind, it's time to learn, laugh, and play.
James's Corner. It's James's Corner. It's James's Corner.
Let's do it up. Let's get nasty with immigration. Does that work? Is that a thing?
No? Okay. It's a little shaky.
I'm all about going to the past to see where we are and how the fuck we got there, right? I'm all about
that. Okay, yeah, oh my God, yes.
It's like, where am I? How did this happen? And it's just a lot of things that I feel like were never discussed that just don't get discussed in history. So, you know, we already talked about two episodes ago, we talked about the Bracciato program, which brought Latinos specifically from Mexico here and how that immigration funnel to the U.S. and dependency on cheap labor from specifically Mexico was formulated. And we also already know, you know, that, you know, we all know history, or the history according to, you know, Ben Carson, that blacks arrived here through cruise ships from Africa.
Yeah, willingly. It was like a Gilligan's Island situation. They were like, we just got lost to sea.
They were like, I heard about this American dream and I want me some of that. So we already know how the Latinos got here, how the black community got here.
Stop it.
But now let's take a look about, I don't necessarily think that I did not necessarily know, just the history behind Asian immigration to the U.S. So let's take a look at a little timeline. And I think this is going to also feed into, I think it's going to lead into a discussion about the model minority and where that came from and what is that. And once we know the history, we can pick that apart. So
love it.
All comes down to, in the very beginning, like with any sort of immigration, comes down to money,
right? Trade
money,
and
money,
such.
Money.
So the U.S. Has had trade deals with Asian nations since the mid 19th century, and I would say specific Asian nations. Mm-hmm. So in 1842, there was the Treaty of Nanjing. So that's when Great Britain essentially forced China to open up its ports for trade after they lost the Opium War. So
God damn it.
Which is like, everybody has been loving opium for a long time. Yeah. You've been so addicted to the opiates. There was a fucking war. I want that opium. Give me that opium.
I need to relax.
Everybody needs to calm the fuck down and meditate, okay? Fucking
yeah,
meditate.
We don't need opiates to relax.
And still a lifelong problem. So that happened. So it's like they lost the war and they're like, open up your door so we can get them opium. And after that, the
doors
were
ridiculous.
So once the doors were open from Great Britain, the U.S. was like, oh, hey. And then they were able to secure with the Qing government, the Treaty of Wangxia. And I'm pretty sure that's how you spell it because it's phonetically spelled out. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Cool.
Wangxia. So then in 1852, Matthew Perry, he
not from Friends.
No, this is the Matthew Perry. He's at a
he's really old. He's a time traveler. Well,
this is Commodore Matthew C. Perry, not to be confused with Matthew Perry from the Commodores or Matthew C. Perry from Friends.
Yes. It's a popular name.
Apparently. Well, he was dispatched to open the doors of Japan to American trade, which I also love this. A lot of this information I'm getting from is from the Oxford, like their historical website. Mm.
Which is an excellent resource.
Which is, but I love like the way that they were like, they said that, you know, he was dispatched to open the doors of Japan to American trade. I'm pretty sure through some like, I mean.
Okay, James, you're bringing up a good point that I have to interject as your neighborhood friendly librarian.
Yes.
Every article, no matter where it's written, who it's written by or how it's written, has a bias.
Yeah.
And if you are a good researcher, you will notice the bias like you just did. I am giving you props for noticing the bias. You know that it's coming from Oxford, which is a university in England. Mm-hmm. So of course, when they're telling their story, they're going to at least soften the blow of things that are not favorable in their light. So thank you, James, for pointing to that. I appreciate it.
They went down there, kicked down the door, burnt all the shit on fire, punched people in the face and said, give me that trade. And that's what happened. So then 1854, mission accomplished. Because you get the treaty of good Matthew Perry, successful. For once, or at least it's been a while since he's had a hit. That was Japan. So that was the Treaty of Kanagawa. And then in 1871, the U.S. also took action against Korea. They imposed the Treaty of Amity and Commerce on the United Kingdom. And that happened of the kingdom that was in Korea. So that happened in 1882. So by the time you get to 1882, the U.S. has, they're like, we're getting all this trade from all these Asian nations that they've forced into this trade. So when you naturally have trade with other countries, like you're not just going to be importing their goods. You're going to get some of the people are going to be like, hey, what's that over there? Like, where are my goods going? I want to go over there too. So you open.
We're trading shit. Let me go there.
It's a two-way street, right? So you start developing this relationship. And I think, you know, the Dutch is a really good example of that because they had, you know, they've been a major trading port since for like the last 800 years. And that's when you go to Amsterdam, it's pretty diverse. At least Amsterdam. You go outside, it gets, you know, very white European again.
Oh, as with most port cities, tend to be diverse, and the rest tend to be not so diverse.
Exactly. So specifically, you had the Chinese really got involved in the gold rush period. So from 1848 to 1855, they were like, I'm going to go get me some of that gold, too. And that also, but also not just them, but there was a huge influx of them. And you see still remnants of this when you go to different cities, like especially like in San Francisco, where you and I both spend a lot of time or used to.
Yeah, I mean, when I can cross that bridge, I go there from time to time.
I was all up over there.
I know, you lived there.
I did for six glorious years. So also, so other people did too from Latin America and Europe and Australia. Everybody was all about that gold. So then after that was also followed by the Japanese, followed the Koreans, From the British colonies, part of Asia and India would also follow there. And then, to add to boot, after the Spanish-American War, the U.S. got the Philippines. And the U.S. was like, I'm gonna take that country. And the the Filipinos were also allowed to enter into the U.S. with no problem. It was like, oh, okay, great. So you had all these, like, free, open, and everyone just going, la-da-da-da. And then what happens, and so, and also thinking this is prior to World War II, the Asian population was about, it was small. Prior to World War II, it was about 250,000.
Okay.
So then,
oh, that's tiny.
In 1882, Americans, and again, at this point, you can really say America, this is just white Americans, really. So, in 1882, they were like, there are too many other people around here. So then they introduced the Chinese.
Here we go again.
And this is why it's so fascinating, because, like, listening to this, I'm like, wait a minute, this seems very familiar. Chinese Exclusion Act. It is what it says. So, and from the Chinese Exclusion Act, it spawned many.
They were not sugarcoating any shit with that one.
There was not just like, oh, we're trying to keep America safe act. It was like, buy China, get out of here.
Get out of here.
So, the Chinese Exclusion Act, which from that spawned more laws and amendments to exclude even more. So, it barred entry of Chinese laborers for about 61 years. Diplomatic negotiations between the U.S. and Japan excluded the Japanese in about 1907. So the Japanese were able to work out a deal around 1907. In 1917, an immigration law denied entry to those from the British colony in India. So they just started, like, chomping down at the bits of, like, who was allowed in. And then
you can't come.
Just shutting down the borders. But we'll take your goods, but you just keep your people over there.
Ugh, God.
So Asian immigrants were categorized around this time as alien, ineligible for citizenship by law or court decisions. So then in 1924, this is, the roaring 20s, Immigration Act created the Asia-Pacific Triangle. And so what that allowed them to do was just bar all immigrants from all Asian countries. So the 1924...
Racism!
Just like, wait a minute, we can shut it down. Because it all started with this one act, so they were able to add little laws based on that act of that. And then the last country standing in 1934 was the Philippines, still holding it down, still being able to come up into the U.S. nice and freely. But then the Tidings McDuffie Act came in and was like,
oh, here we go.
You know what they did? They granted independence to the Philippines. And so then they were like, great, now you're free. You can't come in here.
Rude. Oh, not even rude. Racist, horrible, terrible. That's what it is.
So, they were only, I think it says here that it reduced Filipino immigration to about 50 per year. So you can get like 50.
50?
50, yeah. That's what this.
50?
Yeah. So then World War II happened, right? And so World War II happened. And who was one of the countries that the U.S. was at war with?
Germany.
And?
Japan. I know. I was just taking the snarky way because we never really hear about any German Exclusion Act.
It didn't happen.
The America Free of Brittany Act, like, the British people out of America.
There were certain countries, there are certain European countries where they're like, we don't want you coming into here. There were some of those, but
That's true. We're not going into that right
now. Not talking about this. This is all about, our relationship with Asia for today. Put a pin in that for another time.
Japan.
So we're fighting Japan. And so the U.S. was like, Oh, hey, China, just kidding. We love you. Just resist Japan, because they didn't want them to, like, side with Japan or anything like that. So to boost China's resistance in 1943, they were like, doors are open again.
Thanks, America.
Yeah, the Citizens Committee to Repeal Chinese Exclusion organized a group. It was a group called the Friends of China. And it was, they had the Magasin Act, which was signed by FDR. And the Magasin Act essentially repealed all the Chinese Exclusion Acts. And then it provided an annual quota of 105 for Chinese immigration and granted Chinese immigrants naturalization rights.
Meanwhile...
Right. I know exactly what you're gonna say. Like, meanwhile, like, you know, during this time period, still also think about this, like, you know, there's a path to citizenship and equality for folks who were not even born here. And I'm not trying to be like, you know, pit us against each other, but it's just so interesting that they had a path to naturalization when black folks born in this country didn't even have a pathway to naturalization and to be able to vote and be full citizens.
Right. It was opening up just for trade and treaty and making sure that we have allies. Meanwhile, we have American citizens who are just of Japanese descent that we're interning. Like, something's not right in the water.
Being very specific, and like, it all comes down to money. And there was this quote that, you know, they strategically recast Chinese in this, around this time, they strategically recast the Chinese in promotional materials as saying that they're law-abiding, peace-loving, and courteous people living quietly among us. So they were able to pit the difference between the Chinese and the Japanese. So also creating some, like, sentiment and aggression there, right? And so
pitting one against each other. Crazy, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so at this time, though, folks were like fearing that the influx of, you know, Chinese were going to, again, take away their jobs and drive up, you know, that they were going to be doing they were going to take all these migrant worker jobs or, I mean, jobs that these folks even back then probably were not even going to be, you know, wanting to do. Right.
Yeah. A tale as told as racism.
Yeah, a tale as old as racism. And so once that act, the Magnuson Act, then opened up the door to end the exclusion of other groups. So 1946, the exclusion of Filipinos and Indians also ended, providing that the Philippines and India each had a quota of 100. So there was like, we're opening up the doors, but there's a quota of how many that can enter in there. And Pakistan also, once it gained its independence in 1947, they were allowed entry into there as well. And then Japan, their exclusion ended in 1952. Underneath the McCarran-Walter Act, which brought the Asian exclusion to an end. So essentially, it then took that Asian Pacific Triangle concept and flipped it, and they Missy Elliotted it, and they flipped it and reversed it. I love that I could say that coded language. You knew exactly what I was talking about. I'm like,
of
they pulled
I
a
do.
They pulled a Missy Elliott, and I could just say I no more.
What you're talking about.
You already know. So they were like, well, now all these Asian nations, they can all come in, but there was an annual quota of I think like 100 for each one of the nations and whatnot.
That's
and those quotas would they would change at different points in time. Like sometimes it would be a few over time. It would be like over like a few hundred thousand for this group or a few hundred thousand for that group. It would, or for the entire continent. I think like at one point it was like 200,000 for the Asian continent, like 120,000 for Europe. So this then as we move into like the Cold War, what would happen is they had different acts and things that would happen. Like there was the 1945 War Brides Act, which granted so after the war, there essentially was a lot of acts that would be passed of like if your family member, like so different war, like Chinese American war veterans were able to bring their family members over. So there's this idea of keeping families together. So if essentially at this point, as we go into the 40s and even into the 50s, if you knew somebody, you could get in.
Okay.
But the idea was why originally Congress was okay with passing this was because there were so few Asian Americans at this time in the country that they thought, well, there's not that many of them.
What's
right?
a cousin so, or two?
Well, so they assumed that this act would actually just increase the movement from Europe. So it would just pretty much, you know, keep America white for more.
Oh, so they're thinking that they're bringing like their German cousins over.
Yep, and you know what? Did not happen because these folks were like, I got this auntie, this cousin, this person all coming over here. And you know what? You know why they're having to do that? Because you done fucked up their country, America.
Yes.
You went over to someone's house, kicked their
door
down.
Stomped all over it.
Took all their riches, was like, give me that, and I'm going to take this. And
meanwhile, saying, America's the best. America is awesome. Of course you want to go to that awesome best place ever.
Because when you're at their house taking all their shit, you're also telling them how amazing your own goddamn house is. So then the people are going to be like, well, can I come see this house? You taking my shit? Can I go take a look over there too? I'm going to ride this boat or this plane and get over there. I just want to work this little small little job over here. Is that okay?
Right. And then America's like, no, fuck you.
Yeah. So you also had like a lot of different and also a lot of the immigration was also coming through from refugees. So you had refugees from the Vietnam War, Korean War, Cambodia, Laos. Again, all things that like we done fucked it up, right? So a lot of these folks were coming in from these different places. And so Ford and Carter signed a lot of executive orders to push past the quotas because the quotas were only allowing for so many people to be able to come in. So they
good,
had to sign executive orders for
let more people in.
Yeah, because these people are in danger, because it's like you started that fire over there and these people need out. You helped create this chaos over there.
Let me get out of it.
So around this time, around through like the 50s and 60s, as different laws were being changed, they also got more stringent on sort of you kind of had to have a job to be able to come over here. So there would have to, an employer would have to say, oh, Aneke's going to come over here and work in my, like at my company or my factory or something. So they started cracking down a little bit. They started cracking down on, if you had a family member, there was a process and a pathway for you to get here. It was probably the easiest way. That's how a lot of women, came over here, because their husbands were already over here or whatnot.
Right. Yeah. So
that was their pathway to there. Employers had to write a document, and there was even different quotas. Or they had to write a document saying, like, okay, she can come over here and work, or he can come over
like
there
like a work permit kind of thing.
Essentially, that's
work
how that
visa,
kind of,
I guess.
Yeah, that's kind of how that sort of birthed there. But anyways, once you were here, all of these folks from these Asian countries had a clear pathway to naturalization. They all had, and this is throughout this entire time period. If at any point you were able to legally come over here, you also had hand in hand a pathway to naturalization.
Okay, so if you're here, you can become an American.
Yep. So it's interesting. So then we get to the myth of the model minority. And as I was, you know, coming through this information, it was sort of just like, well, of course, I see where that's coming from. This idea, this idea that is also coined by white folks.
Yes.
The model minority. I forget the name of the guy, but I don't even want to continue giving his name power or anything. But he coined this idea pretty much back in the 60s. Here you had, and this is in the 60s, right? So he pointed out, he was like, Japanese Americans are some of the most, you know, successful that we have here, even though we put them in internment camps. And he's like, you know, they should still have all this emotional trauma from that, but yet they're still able to make it work. Meanwhile, he says, like, the Negro.
This guy. That's exactly what I was afraid of.
But he's like, you know, and so that's, so you have, because there's this paradox,
right?
Look at all these, you know, Asian folks were able to make it. Why can't the black people do, why can't black folks do it in the same way?
Which is bullshit because of everything you just explained.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, there's been a lot of great Asian American writers and, you know, professors and stuff who are just trying to debunk this model minority, you know, myth, essentially, because, you know, there is on the one sense, OK, they came over the quote unquote, you know, right way. But let's start from the very beginning. How did black folks come to this nation?
Stolen and forced to work for free until death.
For centuries. And this wasn't just like a period of time. This was for centuries. And so it's like, even when you had like the blockades against, you know, specific Asian American countries at different times, it was like for decades. It wasn't even for more than a century, right? So there wasn't even enough time for that to get really seeped in. And I know that there were horrific conditions that, you know, Chinese immigrants worked during, things like the construction of the railroad.
Saying that the plight was we're not trying to compare. We're just telling stories.
Right. Yeah. And just to sort of debunk this idea of the model minority and where it came from. And also one of one of the writers I was reading, you know, brought up the point that, you know, Asia's hella diverse. It's not monolithic. Yes. It's hella diverse. And so, you know, Japanese Americans had done really well, but apparently Bhutanese Americans have far higher rates of poverty than other Asian populations, right? So it's not like it's one thing across the board. And then you also have to look at like how specific America was in selecting and allowing different Asian cultures.
Right.
Not only were they able to come here, but their pathway to citizenship, right?
Right, exactly. And the way that
they were even treated when they got here, like they were still seen as human in certain ways. Sure, there was still different racism and stuff that was happening, but like black folks down in the South, like, and last week we talked about the tests that were done on black folks, from the Tuskegee study to, you know, Venus Hottentot, right? Like, or Sarah Bartman, where for so long we were seen as other and inferior. And sure, they did that back in World War II with the Japanese to try to paint fear into the eyes of the Americans when they thought about the Japanese. I think it just was not at the same level or the same way that it happened with black folks in America.
Right. And I really want to emphasize the fact that we're debunking the myth of the model minority because it is patronizing. It is incredibly, this is being named something by the other. Like, oh, bravo to you. Like, it is going without context. It is comparing and essentially doing what you were talking about before, where they essentially were pitting races against each other. Calling one group a model minority is, in fact, pitting it against other minorities. So
that was the idea, because honestly, like, Aneke, like, if you're coming into, like, a strange place, like, it's human nature that if someone gives you a slight pass and a slight title and a slight privilege, you're probably gonna take it. Literally, survival instincts take
to survive.
Right? So you have these communities coming in, and you see the way this other group of people are being treated. You don't want to be lumped in with that, right? So you just go your pathway, you do your thing, and
I hate to say this because it's so depressing to say this, but I said this yesterday when I was out to lunch. But no, whenever somebody comes to this country, they are trying to distance themselves from being Black. Let's just say the truth. Because Black people were brought here as slaves. They were brought here as subordinates, as not people, as inhuman, as chattel. They were granted humanity. Gee, thank you, America. And then everybody, we've constantly been trying to work our way up from that. So now if you're coming here to America and you're facing your own type of discrimination, you're going to try and separate yourself by being like, look, I'm not that though.
Yep,
and that, I think, is the plight of America, and that's where the model minority comes from, I think.
You even see this in the LGBT community, of circling back to the thing of, like, why some, you know, folks don't like seeing effeminate men on TV, because they're like, that's not me. I'm the, you know, the model homosexual, right?
The one who
doesn't put their gayness in their face, and it's not like they want the kids and the marriage and the same thing of, like, whatever, quote-unquote, the status quo normality is. So you see that, like, I mean, we as human beings, we're tribes folk, we're community folks, we're pack creatures, right? So we want to belong, we want to feel loved, and we want to feel safe. So again, if someone's granting you power or some privilege and a pass, you're gonna, like, for survival, you're gonna want to, people take it. So I understand that.
Yeah.
So conservative. Mm-hmm. So Janelle Wong, she's the director of Asian American Studies at the University of Maryland. She's wrote a lot of stuff about this, and has been an author on the issue. And she had even named and said that it was a conservative strategy. And she said, on one point, you're ignoring the role that selective recruitment of highly educated Asian immigrants has played in Asian American success. Followed by, secondly, mm-hmm. making a flawed comparison between Asian Americans and other groups, particularly Black Americans, to argue that racism, including more than two centuries of Black enslavement, can be overcome by hard work and strong family values.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. All the snaps.
Yeah. So I just kind of, it was interesting because as I was doing the research on the history of immigration, it started making me kind of put the dots together of, like, where that theory of the model minority had come from. You had a different path to citizenship and to being here in America and to being humanized, because you really, your humanity was never really lost. I still to this day don't understand how Japanese Americans have forgiven the U.S.
I would be fucking pissed as shit.
All day, every day.
Yeah.
Used the only country that ever had a nuclear weapon used against it. And then families who were put into camps.
That's the thing that, and even if you weren't American, it's shameful. But the fact that it was purely based on race/nationality is disgusting. And meanwhile, I had no idea that at the same time that FDR was signing this law to intern Japanese Americans, he was being like, oh, hey, Chinese Americans, come on over. You know, like, it just goes to show that, like you said, it's all based in money and it's all based in perception and racism. And like, that's just what it boils down to.
Even all the wars that we got involved into, it's all about money. You know, if it's not about, like, can we help the specific country? What can you do for us? And it sickens my stomach. And it really broke my heart to, you know, read and see how, you know, Asian Americans were able, like, where you had Black folks who still weren't able to have the right to vote and who were treated like dogs through police brutality and just for centuries. It kind of broke my heart. Whereas folks who were already born here, weren't given that same thing that you could give because you've given it to other people. So that was important to sort of look at there. And Frank Chin said this back in, 1974, he said, whites love us because we're not Black. Sort of that, just sort of like, well, they're not that thing that I, you know, hate so much over there. I do want to give a shout out to, I'm going to pronounce your name wrong. You're one of our corner kids.
Try it out.
Jaywon. Jaywon K.
All right.
And you posted about the, you did a few different posts about the Model Minority Mutiny, which is a group that was being, I think you're in Baltimore. So it's the Baltimore Asian Resistance and Solidarity Group. And they said, they have this, the group, I think they had a meeting and they were talking about how culturally stereotyped in the U.S. is the model minority. People of Asian backgrounds are expected to be smart, wealthy, hardworking, and docile. The model minority myth is full of contradictions, painting Asian Americans as basically white, encouraging complicity with the white supremacy and excluding Asian and Pacific Islanders Americans by perceiving them as perpetual foreigners. API people fighting anti-blackness and white supremacy are often erased from history, while the media pushes narratives about Asian-black tension, fueling hostility between people of color. This this event, and so they had an event that was going to explore that, and there are groups out there that are working to dismantle this, because it's been something that we've been pitted against each other, and it's time to start looking at how this all came about and really seeing our unifications and coming together here.
Oh, I love it. I love this so much. If we, the more that we separate ourselves, the less we, less power we have and less we have to gain. The more that we come together and fight systematic racism, fight sexism, fight homophobia, fight all of the different things that affect all of us, even if you're not a part of that group, it still affects you. It still ricochets onto you. The more power we have.
So the more informed we, then inform yourself with knowledge, my librarian lady friend would also say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And get nasty with that knowledge.
Ooh, that's a good tag.
Get nasty with knowledge. Annie, get your gun. Annie, get your gun.
You
and put it down. Drop it with some knowledge. Your name's not Annie. It's Aneke.
My name is Aneke, and we're talking about ladies.
Annie was also, let's talk about it, boss ass bitch.
She was. She was such a boss ass bitch. She was fucking doing all the rodeo, all the gunslinging.
Doing her thing.
Yeah, doing her thing. So basically, I want to talk about women in power, but the thing that inspired me to talk about women in power was this episode on This American Life, episode 616. Please listen to it. It's amazing. It is all about pirates. And I have a love-hate relationship with pirates. It is kind of interesting to me. I don't really know how
talk to me about this, because I remember back in college, we were not allowed to do anything pirate thing because we went to UC Santa Cruz and like the super PC, like, I mean, very PC. And we went to Porter College, which was like super, like, you know, PC. Extra PC, like super...
Yeah, but nothing's wrong with that.
No, not at all, but super right. And so, like, we were not allowed to do pirates because anything pirate theme, not even space pirates, because pirates rape and pillage.
I mean, yeah, it's true. They were illiterate. They went to different, like, boats and would take their shit, and they would rape it all over the town. It was ridiculous, you know? Like, I don't even know how to, like, really understand why I like them.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so gross.
Yeah.
You know?
Profession of dicks.
Yeah, that's what it boils down to. But at the same time, you know, they stole from, like, rich people, from, like, big corporations and stuff.
Rich-ass people, yeah. Really? Yeah, you're right.
So,
yeah.
You know, so...
I can see that.
Well, anywho, This American Life, this one... Episode 616 is broken into three different acts, and the first act is about this one asshole who goes on a midlife crisis, leaves his family to become a pirate. He like literally is like done and goes.
Yeah, and just like so bored with life that he's like, oh, I want to go be a pirate now.
Yeah, it's like, fuck you, dude. And then the second one is, it's about Somali pirates, which...
Not into it.
Is a little too real for me. You know?
Yeah, not as fun and whimsical for Aneke. Aneke likes a little whimsy in her storytelling.
Exactly. I need a couple hundred years to make it more whimsical.
Some distance in time. A little distance, a little too close.
A little too real.
I saw that Tom Hanks movie and that shit was intense.
Fucking scary as shit. Yeah. I like a little,
when I was on the cruise ship, we used to have to like have conversations about like what happens. Yes, because it would happen. They would get up on the cruise ship sometimes.
That's crazy. On a cruise ship,
there's no guns. No one has any weapons there.
What do you mean you don't have any weapons? What?
Not even security.
What? Not even like a gun? Nobody has a gun?
No, there are no weapons on a cruise ship.
That's weird. That just doesn't seem right to me. Like, how do you protect yourself?
But I think like in some ways, like, I mean, okay, because...
But no one's
coming on board with any weapons.
You don't know who's coming on board with a weapon.
No, but they've been screened.
But what about the pirates? You know, coming on board.
Well, get that flare gun and pray.
I guess. I mean, a flare gun can do some damage, you know? Well, anyways, so the story that I want to talk about is the last story. It's the third act. And it is about this woman pirate lady named Chen Ai Sao. I'm intrigued. Yes, she is really cool. So this lady pirate commanded a ship of over 300 junks manned by 20 to 40,000 pirates.
What?
I know. She had men, women, and children, little bitty babies, all aboard these ships that were all up in the ocean.
Fuck. She was like, children, get to fucking work. Get to pirating.
I know. Exactly. She had a huge ass fleet. It was bigger than the Chinese Navy at the time. It was insane. She's boss ass bitch.
Damn. So she like ruled. Who runs this world? Her.
Yeah. Madam Ching.
Yeah.
And can you believe she did all this shit when she was like 33 years old?
Damn, life goals. Aneke, we need to get on it.
Right? Because
we are behind.
Like,
do you know, like, how did she get into the pirating world? Was she bored into it or?
No. Okay. So she basically was in charge of this prostitute ship kind of thing. So she was commanding that. She ran into this other pirate guy and he convinced her to marry her. At first he was like, marry me. And she was like, nah, I don't want to marry you, bitch. And finally she was like, you know what, I think this might be a really good idea. So she took him up on it, and then after that he died.
Oh, did he die or was she just like,
you know what, you never know, he could have been murdered
by her. You are insinuating some stuff, Aneke.
You were trying to
start a war
with the
most badass pirate witch in the world.
What? No, I'm not. This is just conjecture.
You never know.
It's lore.
I've seen one or two of those Pirate of the Caribbean movies, and I'll tell you this, they always come back.
She's not coming back like with octopus hair or something.
Yeah, so she's like, I heard what you said on your podcast, and I'm not having it.
Like she's listening to my podcast.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so Chang Ai Sao, or Madam Ching, she basically dominated the seas.
Okay.
And she was able to have ports all over the place where she had banking. She ran it like a corporation. Her fleet was so huge that she was able to deplete the Chinese Navy of their ships, where they had to actually go to England. And they were like, excuse me, England, can we have some ships? Because this lady pirate is out here stealing all of our ships, making us look bad while she's taking over not only China, but also Britain and Portugal.
They were like, she took all of our ships.
Yeah, basically, because she was crazy. Like, and the best part about it is she did not let her pirates rape. She was like, no, don't you dare do that.
You know what? That was gonna be one of my questions I was gonna ask. Mm-hmm. I was gonna make a conjecture. Is that the word? Conjecture?
I think so, yeah.
I was going to conjecture that I bet she was like, y'all can be pirates, but no raping.
Yeah, she had no problem with killing, though, but definitely no raping. Punishable by death.
She's like, just don't rape him. She's like, just fucking kill her. Don't rape her.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure her experience on the prostitution ship had something to do with this, but check this out. Along with her not raping the female captors or having her pirates do that, she was also able to be one of the few pirates to actually retire. She just came into port and one day just retired.
Damn. When she was like, eventually she's a retired pirate.
Yeah, and she made negotiations with the Chinese government to get jobs for her crew, other pirates. She got them jobs with the Chinese Navy, which is insane. Yeah. And she also just kind of rested at home for the rest of the time.
See, this is like, I saw a really boring, unimpressive movie trailer for the next Pirates of the Caribbean. And I'm like, why?
Yeah.
But like, this was a missed opportunity to have this badass real life pirate woman up in the mix with her octopus pair and slicing and dicing.
I know. Which is like so irritating to me. There's diversity back in the 1800s on the high sea, and we don't even get that in our movies.
She just would have looked like really like hardcore and just like cool, you know?
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
Like, could have been played by Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah.
Or what's that one woman? She was starring in Crouching Tiger, and then she was also in Rush Hour 2.
Oh, yes. Yeah, but I was also thinking like maybe like a Constance Wu. She's Jessica and Fresh Off the Boat. Do you know?
Oh, yeah. I think it would be dope to see. Chinese female pirate just fighting it up. She'd have to sword fight.
Oh, fuck yeah.
She's going to kick too.
Okay, why not? Like, you know, might as well go full-fledged. I mean, fuck it. Why don't we just have like a whole movie devoted just to lady pirates out there doing their thing on the high fucking sea, just yo-hoing it up, not raping anybody, just like living that life, stealing that money, you know, getting all that cash ola. I don't know. What do you think?
Badass pirate bitches, witches.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there we have it. Before we head out, I do want to read a quick little review. This review comes from a text thread. I had to read this. A friend of mine, Ruda, texted me in response to listening to last week's episode. He wrote, "So I typically blast music at the gym, but today I blasted the latest episode of Minority Corner. It was motivating, hilarious, depressing, frustrating, and downright pissed me the fuck off. I came out of the gym clutching my pearls and pumped." Bravo. Clutching my pearls and pumped. I think that should be the new catchphrase and on a t-shirt. Ruda, thank you for listening. Again, like, I hope this show and these episodes continue to be a place of knowledge, comfort, joy, healing, and empowerment. Isn't it also interesting that the word PC has become sort of a dirty word? I was listening to myself say that in this week's episode. I was clutching my pearls, but I wasn't meaning it in that sense. But like, that word has been just bastardized to all hell's heaven. So I don't know if you got that or had that same experience, but like, interesting. We've got some great guests and co-hosts coming up onto the podcast. My dear friend and podcaster Vignette Ching is going to be here on Friday. We are going to get into it. A lot of work to be done. And also a special call out. You all know I'm a huge fan of therapy. Psychology Today has an amazing database of therapists just waiting for you. You can filter them to what it is that you need. If you're looking for a Black gay therapist, they've got them. They'll find one in your area. A special shout out to our AAPI brothers and sisters. Y'all, like, if you're not in therapy, definitely get in. There's a lot that is happening. It's not going to stop overnight. And it's so important to make sure that we are mentally taking care of ourselves. I know similarly, there's a lot of overlap between our, you know, cultures, at least, you know, in the Black community. Therapy has been frowned upon for a good while. And I imagine a lot of other cultures have similar experiences with that. But we have to move beyond that because we must take care of ourselves. So that's my advice from your Black brother over here. That's it. And that's for everybody. Get into therapy now. As my acting instructor told us on graduation day, he said, get into therapy now. Most people wait before it's too late. It was also his advice to someone on their wedding day. They're getting married to their wife. Get into therapy now. Most people wait before it's too late. So it works for couples too. All right, y'all. We will get back into it on Friday. I love you all so much. Be well. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves as well. And thank you for listening to Minority Corner, because together, we're the majority. Love y'all.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.